It's funny because at one point in my defense, it was at the very end, the external examiner was like, you know, this is the point where we normally would have you leave the room. And then when you come back in, we would give you a huge hug. In some ways, I'm like, man, I would have loved that hug.
Hello, and welcome to episode 3 of Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee with Dr. Justin Winzenberg and me, Stephen Jones. Today, we'll be joined in the second half by our friend and colleague, McYoung Yang.
So what's been a highlight for you this week? I think I can guess, but what's been a highlight?
Yeah, I think I have two highlights on a lesser note. One of my highlights was actually just taking a walk around town. I feel like I've had a lot of work to do lately with various projects and things. And it kind of helps me just to go out and go on a walk. And a lot of times I go on a walk with Teddy and Jill and baby Lucas, but lately, I went on a couple walks by myself and kind of just walked around town, and having so much familiarity with Hopkins, it just kind of made me feel at home. So that was refreshing. So that's the kind of the little highlight. Of course, the bigger highlight is that I passed my PhD defense. And I tell you, all of those questions and all of those kind of anxieties that you have not knowing how it's going to go, it ended up quite well, and I was surprised actually at how smoothly it went. My examiners were very gracious, and my external examiner in particular was very complimentary about my work, and so that was super helpful.
That is so exciting. I think so. Actually, one of my highlights this week was that you successfully defended your dissertation.
Yeah, I mean, you've been on this journey with me for so long. I mean, I think about how many times we've talked about it and talked about just anxieties around it. So I appreciate it.
Yeah, and I think also maybe selfishly it gives me hope, right?
For sure.
That it's possible.
There were so many times I didn't think I was going to finish. So if I can finish, man, anybody can finish. And I think you'll be just fine.
I don't know if you heard, but yesterday when you called and told me that you had passed, Jenny figured out what conversation I was having, and she yelled across the driveway. She was like, "Yay, Justin!" So,
that's great.
Yeah, there was much celebrating here. I have one other highlight I'll sneak in here real quick, which is that I made curry last night. And
nice.
We used to have a friend from Malaysia that lived with us, and he would make curry pretty often. And I didn't realize how much I had missed that. And so, like, I mean, my curry is not as good as his curry, but it was good. And I don't know. There's just something about that. It seems like my highlights seem to have a lot to do with food.
That's not a bad thing.
Okay, low light. Oh, man, the news this week, like in the last week, was really rough.
Yeah, what part of it stuck out to you as being dark?
I mean, there's a lot that felt dark to me. But I think especially news out of D.C., you know, just... I think I had this hope that maybe we would be able to move past some of the partisan stuff that we've been in, you know, with the chaos that we're in. And I think there've been moments of that, but I feel like this week was not one of those. I feel like there was a lot of partisanship as well as, I don't know, self-promotion, those kinds of things. And just, yeah.
Isn't it interesting how much even just the COVID issue has been politicized in a lot of ways, and how there have been kind of lines drawn in the sand politically with different parties? And
no, like, so going out grocery shopping, I almost feel like wearing a mask, I feel like I'm making a political statement, which is not my goal, right? Like, I'm just like, I don't want people I know to get sick. I mean, I don't want to get sick either, right? So I'm wearing a mask. But it feels like, and maybe it's where I live, but I just feel like it's this weird political statement that I'm not trying to make.
For sure, yeah. It's like there are these different narratives being kind of told by both major political parties, and it's all related to interpreting what's going on with COVID stuff. And it's just very interesting how it became political when really it's like it's a medical, you know, issue, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And biology and dealing with, you know, infectious diseases, but it can become so politicized.
Yeah. What's a low light for you this week?
Yeah, mine's kind of related actually to that a little bit. I got into a bit of a text message I don't know if I want to cut an argument, dispute with a loved one. And it was around the COVID issue, and it got kind of heated. And I found this unhealthy aspect of myself, which is that I really like to argue, but that I don't like to argue and let it go. Like, especially if for some reason I feel like my points aren't being validated. And by validated, I don't feel like having to be agreed with as much as having to be, you know, having your hat tipped to the fact that you're making like a legitimate argument, you know? Mm-hmm. And so when I feel like the person isn't doing that, I think I kind of get into this kind of unhealthy argumentative mode. And so I kind of had to back off a little bit, but at the same time, I said some things I think that were, I don't know, hard, maybe even hard truths to that person about.
So not necessarily kind of things you shouldn't have said.
No, not things I shouldn't have said, but just kind of letting the person know the ways that their text messages can be interpreted. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just those conversations are never fun. And especially through text message, it's like, it's the worst avenue to have those kinds of things. But it revealed again, and this is something I've been aware of for a while, especially because this has happened to me in my fantasy football leagues, but I get into these argumentative modes about things that I don't think are like core parts of my beliefs, but they're just things I find myself liking to argue about.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fun. It's something I need to scale back at times.
I think that it's hard right now to scale back on any of those tendencies because like some of those things I think are part of how we deal with stress, you know?
For sure. But I've noticed this pattern, you know, long before there were definite stresses in my life, I feel like. And so it's a little bit of both maybe for me.
Yeah, that's fair. What's an insight you've had this week?
Well, yeah, that's good. I suppose there's some insight in some of the things I was just reflecting on. One other thing, I guess, to maybe tie back into one of my highlights for this week. I had this interesting experience as I was on my walk through town, and that is that I realized that like Hopkins as a town, since this is, I lived in Hopkins growing up for most of my childhood, and I've lived here now in my adult life, and I realize how many places around town are kind of riddled with my own personal blemishes. Mm. Like I see locations and spots, and I remember having done things there or having had an argument or having, you know, even just done bad things, you know, as a kid. So I realized, man, there's a lot of pain, painful memories I have about my experience in this town, and I see it in specific places. On the other hand, I'm also realizing now in my adult life, and actually even going back to my childhood, there are moments of grace and moments of just incredible growth as well that have been so meaningful, you know, as part of my experience. And now I even have moments where, you know, my son, I can see him, you know, riding his bike around certain areas. So they're not painful memories, they're actually joyous memories. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of interesting that blend. I've been in town for so long in many ways that I've got both those experiences of both painful memories, but also extremely, you know, joyful memories and also memories of God's work in my life in all these places.
It's really interesting to think about the intersection between identity and space.
Yeah.
You know, and locate like culture and place, which is, you know, a thing that for me, I don't feel like I have quite as much personally because I don't really ever feel like I've been from a place because I grew up moving around.
Yeah. And it makes me think about students that are at home right now and trying to do their schoolwork from home, that they may have similar experiences where home for them could be just a place of joy and a place of where God's met them, but home could be a place of pain.
Yeah.
And I feel like that my reflecting on this walk experience that I had around town reminded me that if there are students who have really painful memories and have a bad taste in their mouth about their current home situations that they're having to be in, that there's a lot of room for redemption there. There's a lot of room for God to work in it. And those painful memories can be maybe overcome by new experiences. How about for you?
For me, an insight. So one would be, so I was having a conversation the other day with a couple of people I've been working with at the college, and we were talking about how one thing that this whole virtual learning thing that we're doing right now is showing is some of the weakness of not being in space together. So kind of that theme of, you know, geography and place and how important that is. Because even though I think my students are learning, I had a great exercise this week with over the last week and a half doing model diplomacy. The Council on Foreign Relations has this whole model diplomacy thing. I've never done it virtually before. It actually worked really well. It's probably One of the things I'm most excited about that we've done since going virtual.
That's cool.
But I would say overall, what we have been encountering is that it's increasingly difficult for students to stay engaged. You know, whether or not they have their cameras on, it seems to be kind of a similar feeling that there seems to be this reality that we're missing out on something really critical. And I think that insight matters because higher ed is in such a moment of flux. You know, who knows what it'll look like. I think yesterday I saw that there was the first college that I'm aware of that closed down. I think it was in Ohio that closed down specifically related to the whole COVID thing, which wow. is just kind of, yeah, intense to think about.
Isn't it interesting? Think about how in traditional classroom formats, there are a lot of times where we try to discourage students from being on their computers, being on their phones in the middle of class because it's a distraction. Mm-hmm. And that's not always the case. You know, some people have really worked the technology into their classroom well, but for a lot of the traditional model, it's like, all right, now close your computers. Now don't look at your computers. You know, pay attention to the conversation, contribute to the conversation. Now we're trying to have to navigate students doing classroom formats where they're on their computers by necessity right. just to be part of the classroom. And then the capacity to try to multitask or to be having their emails open, or they're probably not having their emails open, right? They're probably, you know, doing other things. And it's not that the younger generation maybe doesn't have a greater capacity to navigate that sort of, you know, multitasking in ways that maybe some of the older folks don't, but it does provide challenges, doesn't it?
To yeah.
the sort of virtual classroom format that where you can't really say, okay, now, you know, pay attention. Now don't be on your computer, on your phone.
One of the things I've been thinking about with that is this question of how do we, as we try to build the higher ed of the future, what does that look like? And I think there has to be some element of that where people are together.
Yeah.
And I know we've shifted to a lot of online learning, and I think there are really good elements of that. I've been really grateful. My programs, both of my grad programs have been limited residency. So I've like actually known, had a face-to-face relationship with my faculty and my classmates. And it's just something I've been thinking about this week, you know, as we think about what we're finding with students.
Yeah. And then the importance to not just lament those challenges, but to try to find creative ways to make them an advantage or something, or maybe even a more positive experience. Mm-hmm. It's going to require some innovation on the part of a lot of us who are used to kind of just the traditional format of you're sitting in class together and you're chatting or you're lecturing. And so I think in some ways this unwelcome necessity to move everything to virtual learning could be a moment of growth for how we do education, mm-hmm. right? For our pedagogy, but it's not going to be easy and it's going to take a lot of reflection. I feel like I haven't even had time myself to kind of step back and reflect on some of the processes that have been happening in the virtual classroom.
Right.
Maybe once the semester's up, it'll be nice to sit and reflect on it. Or maybe it'd be interesting even to get a forum together with other profs and just chat about their experiences. I know we've kind of been doing some of that.
It'd be nice to do anything together.
There is that. Yeah. I wonder how long it's going to take for all of this to really settle in terms of the feeling distant from people. It's not that maybe we're not already feeling it now, but how much longer of this we could take mm-hmm. without really feeling it in some pretty significant ways.
I feel like I started to feel it this week more. Hmm. I had a moment last week where I started to feel some hope. Like in a new way. It was like, I don't know. It was weird. It felt like,
was it something that had happened or
no, that was what was weird is I did not generate that hope. It felt like it was something the Lord gave me as a gift, right? Like, hey, there's a bigger picture. There's something still going on. And, I remember telling Jenny, I was just like, hey, I feel really hopeful today. and I was like, but it's not from me. It's not something I did. And it was really refreshing. And then the first 3 days of this week, I just feel like that's just been the screws have really been tightened on that. And I really feel, it's easy to kind of have the walls close in, you know, and so, okay, here's an insight that I had.
Yeah.
that I've been thinking about is that, one of the things we talk about with culture, like when you move across cultures, is that one of the things that can be really difficult with that is that there's a large part of who you are that is actually a reflection of the people around you and the patterns that you have because of the people around you.
And that totally makes sense.
And then when you're not around those people, you don't have those same patterns. Yeah, there are elements of yourself that start to be missing, and that plays out in all sorts of ways.
I remember feeling that even as I was at college, and I would go home for the summer. And you're removed from all, I mean, I had made so many really deep and solid friendships in college that to be removed from some of those for like a whole summer felt really odd. And you kind of don't feel like the same person,
right?
Sometimes. And it's not like I was acting completely different in my home environment, but I'm around my family, I wasn't having any of the same kinds of conversations necessarily with my family that I was having in college. I wasn't able to enjoy some of the same things, you know, with my friends in college, because we just had these patterns of having fun together and right. of having conversation, or, you know, even praying together, things like that. It's so interesting, isn't it, how that kind of stuff, and you don't even often realize that it's happening. You kind of feel it, but you don't think about it much.
It looks like our guest is here.
We'll be right back in a moment with McYoung Yang.
Today, we have the privilege of talking with McYoung Yang, a friend and colleague of ours at Crown College. And so we're really happy to have you with us here today, McYoung.
Yeah, it's an honor to be here.
I'd be interested to know, are there conversations that are happening, you know, in your circles of the Hmong community that you don't feel like are necessarily being had in the wider culture as it relates to COVID-19?
I think it's just due to the racial tension, I think we become more aware of, you know, how necessary it is for the church to kind of come behind that, right, and have broader conversations. And so I've just become more aware of just how important that is now that it has impacted me directly, you know, that, I've always been aware of racial tensions and the necessity to engage those. But I think with this pandemic, it's kind of put it at the the front burner. I've seen kind of the necessity and the importance of how the broader church can speak into those realities, if that makes sense.
What would some of the experiences of racial tension look like?
Yeah, I think even just the, you know, sometimes we can't, like as a family, we can't go to the store, right? Because, you know, they need to limit people in the stores. And so when my wife's like, I want to go to the store, you know, I'm thinking, is that safe? You know, is somebody going to verbally attack her, physically attack her, or, you know, there's just things like that where there's a tension now of, is it safe to even, you know, walk outside or, you know, present myself, especially when you're in a place like Waconia, which Waconia is not bad, but it's predominantly white, you know, where you're not like in the cities where there's a lot of different ethnicity in the cities. But when you're in a small place, and a lot of the stories that I've heard in regards to kind of racism toward Asians is done in small towns. So now that we live in a small town, it's like, you know, should my wife go to the grocery? But if we can't go together, you know, how are we going to deal with that? So my wife and I, we've had conversations, and she's felt anxious even just going to Target.
Yeah, I had an interesting conversation with a friend of mine who, you know, was kind of scoffing at the idea of, I don't see why it's a big deal to call COVID-19 like the Chinese flu or the Asian flu or something like that, whatever, you know, whatever some of the politicians were calling it to start. How do you react when you kind of hear people dismissing that as not a big deal? Do you think that there's more to it than what my friend was saying? Because I think their idea was like, well, that's where it originated, so I don't see what the big deal is.
Yeah, I mean, there's some truth to that, right? But I think it perpetuates a narrative. And people take it to this extreme where, again, now all Asians, so if it's just that's where it originates and, you know, we're calling it that, then I think I don't have any problem with that. But again, it's creating a narrative that all Asians have it, you know, all Asians, you know, are spreading it. And so I think that's really where the issue lies. it's creating a narrative against Asians that, I mean, we're just, we're like everyone else, you know, I'm like every other American where I'm trying to not get it. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to not pass it forward. So I feel like we're all in the same boat, and all of a sudden this narrative is out there, and, you know, it kind of hits you, it blindsides you, like, oh, I wasn't even thinking of that.
Do you know when you first realized, like, do you remember when you first realized that this had become a racialized event?
I don't know. I guess I've been so kind of, you know, we all been kind of locked in our own little world, right? But I guess, you know, in Facebook, when majority of my friends are Hmong, and, you know, you kind of try to ignore it and kind of just block it out. But once I started to hear, like, my friends talk about their experiences of going to the store and stuff like that and experiencing it, I'm like, man, this is pretty crazy. So I started to realize that it's a real thing, you know? Because, I mean, when you hear news, you know, especially in our day and age, fake news and stuff like that, you're just kind of like, oh, you know, what's going on? I haven't experienced it. But then once I started to see friends on Facebook, you know, tell their stories, I'm just like, man, this is something that's really, really happening.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen and I were talking earlier just about how the wider American culture right now seems to be kind of divided politically on the issue, where you hear, you know, certain political strands kind of saying with a great deal of skepticism about even the severity of COVID or the numbers that are being proposed. And then there are those, you know, who are just, you know, very terrified and so deeply concerned. It's like trying to throw every restriction, you know, possible on. Have you found at all that those kind of like lines in the sand are being experienced among the Hmong community? I mean, imagine they are, right? I mean, Hmong Americans are Americans, yeah, too, you yeah know? Yeah. So I'm not trying to make too many assumptions about it, but have you seen some of those trends even developing with community Hmong folks that you're in touch with?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't, in one sense, man, we're out here in Waconia. I haven't really heard much in regards to some of the initial concerns in regards to COVID. I think, again, we're just trying to take our cues from, you know, the broader government and seeing what they're doing. So, in regards to that question, I'm not necessarily too sure, you know, how the broader community or the Hmong community is taking it. But I know that, you know, it being kind of in-house, kind of stuck in the home, I think we all struggle with the same, you know, like what everybody else struggles with, you know, just kind of being stuck. But at the same time, Hmong families, like other ethnic families, they're bigger, right? It's multi-generational in some homes. But I think it's, you know, I think we're used to that. I have a friend who he has eight kids. His eighth one is on the way, you know, and he's just like, yeah, you know, it's normal life, you know. The house is crazy. The house is busy, but that's just how life is.
I was able to briefly see my dad, you know, from a distance this week. And it was just weird because we only live like 10, 15 minutes away. Do you know, have Hmong family patterns been disrupted by all this?
Yeah, I think, I mean, we're, you know, naturally we're more communally driven, right? And so there's more just gatherings. I know that the larger church in general have, yeah, it kind of takes me to kind of Romans 1, where Paul really is longing to be with Rome, right? The church at Rome, really longing to impart spiritual knowledge and things that he's kind of talking about. And I think there's an element there that I think the Hmong people and the Hmong church in general is feeling. They're feeling a longing to be with one another because that's kind of what we do. And so to be constricted from not meeting with one another, I think that has really hindered, because it has made me really think about, I was talking to one of my pastoral buddies, it made me really think about just the whole emergent movement that was kind of happened a while ago, mm-hmm. you know, and
yeah,
just kind of that movement of, and also to the anti-institutional kind of bent that our generation tends to have, and it's like, oh, we don't, you know, we're the organic church, and so there's a really high emphasis on the organic church, and I get that, and I'm kind of sympathetic to that too, to a certain degree, but I think the COVID pandemic has really shifted my thought and said, you know, man, like, we really do need the gathering of the church, you know, we really do need the gathering of the saints, and that's important. But I think that's kind of impacted the Hmong church in that regards, because that's how we function communally. Mm-hmm. To not be able to do that, it really hurts us.
It's kind of interesting, isn't it, how you would think that maybe that sort of emergent movement and the idea of this organic church and not needing institutions would thrive in an environment like this, because it's kind of like, all right, now it's our time, right? Because right. All the institutional aspects are just not even, it's not even able to happen in the midst of the pandemic. But I think you point out a really interesting point, And I think a similar thing actually could be said about colleges and whatnot. You know, there's almost this sense too of like, well, there's ways that we do education in higher ed that are just so much confined to the walls that we've built, and that there's a lot of room now for education to happen outside of that. And I think there is some truth to that, but I think we're finding maybe this longing for institutionalization in ways that is showing that there actually may be a pretty healthy and helpful place for institutions, because people are feeling that sort of displacement away from those things right now, and they're actually looking back and longing for it. So it's funny how I'm hearing from students even that it's not so much like they're saying, oh, this is a breath of fresh air to finally be out of the stagnant walls of Crown College. They're looking and they're thinking back, like, I can't wait to get back. Like, and it's so funny. I would have thought that it would have been like, this had been the time where they're like, you know, I'm not sure I really, you know, appreciate those walls, or I'm not sure I really appreciate, you know, the routine of having to go to church, you know, every Sunday or something. And again, not that people think they have to go to church, but that sense of you would think that this would be the time that anti-institutionalism would be thriving. But I think maybe we're going to see a reaction back towards institutions in some ways because of what they've meant to people and realizing there's actually some benefits to it.
So you mentioned before something about how the church overall has a role in processing this racialized experience of COVID. What kind of roles do you think the church either is playing or should be playing?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I've been challenged, you know, if Justin probably can speak better to this too. I've been challenged by the letter to the Ephesians, right? And as much as Paul is saying, you know, you Gentiles, and he's drawing those lines, those racial lines. You know, I've been challenged to see it that, yes, as much as he's drawing those racial lines, he's also drawing covenantal lines, right? I mean, it's not one or the other. It's a both and. But when he draws the racial line, it's not like, I mean, Justin mentioned kind of the political side of our nation right now. We tend to draw those racial lines. And my fear is that as Asian Christians, right, or Christians who are Asians, we have the tendency, and I know I have the tendency, that once you have that racial tension, you're going to revert back to your camps, you're going to revert back to your people, and you're going to fight from that posture. And also, too, you're going to shoot your brothers and sisters that are Christian.
Which has literally happened right through time. I mean, there's examples of that.
Yeah. So it's like, no, like, let's not look at these lines the way that the world looks at these lines. Let's look at these lines the way that God looks at these lines. That, yes, there are different ethnic groups, and God, and Paul does acknowledge that, but he acknowledges it from the posture or from the perspective of this is God's beautiful design, right? But then in another sense, he's like, but there's this covenantal line where we're one, right? He's made the two one. Mm-hmm. And so as much as I think that, yes, in this pandemic, should Asians stand up and, you know, fight for their voice to be heard? Yes. But I think it would be better if we stood together. It wouldn't be just an Asian voice, right? You know, because in some sense, it's like, oh, of course the Asians would complain, right? Or something like that, right? Because, you know, they're being attacked. But it would be, I think, instrumental for the church universal to stand up and say, hey, you know, we're united, we're one, we're a family. And I think it has substantial grounds.
What are some practical ways that the church can do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think just in that same thread, there have been groups like, again, you know, there have been Asian groups, Christian Asian groups that have sought to come together and to fight together. And in one sense, you know, I feel like, oh, should I jump on that? You know, because it's a good cause. So it's not a good cause. But then you wonder, again, am I just reverting back to the way that the world operates? So I would like to see, you know, how can more non-Asians, white, black, you know, Hispanic, whatever, speak into these and be more vocal? Because sometimes, and again, I'm guilty of this too, right? Again, this situation has made me realize my blind spots. Because sometimes when it's like it's happening to other ethnic groups, you're like, oh, that's not my thing. But maybe this is the time where we stand up and say, no, this is actually the perfect time where I kind of allow my voice to be heard for the sake of my, you know, black brother or Hispanic brother or white brother.
Yeah, even if there is cost to that, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Which I think is part of where that covenantal framing is so important, that if we're in this relationship of promise with each other. And if that's, and if the promise is based in who Jesus is, the depths of that go so deep. I mean, it to me, I just always go back to that Philippians 2 passage, you know, and this caring about each other so deeply. And I mean, Paul just drives it home, right? It's like, you know, how much, well, as much as Jesus did. And he isn't even like as much as Jesus did with, by becoming incarnate. That would be a lot, right? But I mean, it's all the way, you know, to the self-sacrifice to death. I mean, that sense of, do I think of my brothers and sisters from different backgrounds as being so important that I would follow the example of Christ in loving them?
Yeah. I mean, and that's what I'm thinking too, in regards to that the church has substantial grounds to argue from, because even if we go back to just mere politics, right? I mean, you have this movement of like identity politics, and it's just, so when we talk about race, we're talking about identity politics, but there's no ground to really push off of. It's shallow grounds, right? But we actually, as a church, have a rock to step on, which is Christ. You know, this is what unites us. Politics is going to say, well, you know, everybody has their agenda and using identity politics, but we as a church can say, no, it's Christ that is the rock that holds us, you know, in terms of our unity. So I think it's a great opportunity for the church.
Yeah, like what you said about Ephesians. I mean, there were ways, like during that time where Jews and non-Jews were being so segregated, both like theologically, ideologically, even spatially, that it's fascinating to think there were like narratives that were floating around about how peoples in the ancient world could be unified. And a lot of it was through political means and whatnot. And what's so fascinating to me about Ephesians is how the unification of those groups who were warring with each other occurs through Jesus and his blood. It's crazy to think that there was really no other way that such warring groups could be unified together. And yet Ephesians allows that sense of like distinctiveness. It doesn't suggest that they need to like lose their own identity and cultural identity, but they're unified into this one covenantal group, which is so important, but it's through Jesus and through his blood, right? So it's like, this isn't something humanity could afford or could work out on its own, as if there was just going to be some natural peace agreement between these groups who couldn't have thought more differently in some ways. So, I mean, I think you're spot on there. Like there's actually something theologically and even practically that we maybe have to offer as the church to speak about how unification happens among peoples who are widely divergent, who have very different cultural perspectives, different viewpoints. It's so interesting. You know, and then there's that great oneness passage in Ephesians 2 about one Lord, one faith, one baptism, you know, just all of the things too that are foundations to that unity. That are present in church life together. I like what you said there.
So, I'm trying to think through what does it look like to stand together? I mean, particularly when we literally can't, you know, stand together. But you know, is it posting on Facebook? Is it like what is actually a meaningful way of standing with Asian brothers and sisters who are facing, you know, an increased level of prejudice right now?
Yeah, that's a good question, man. I don't know what that would necessarily look like. Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
in some ways, Jones, you're kind of asking the big question, right? when it comes to interacting, you know, from different cultural perspectives, you know, man, it's such a in ways that people who maybe aren't naturally able to understand the vantage point of a person with very different experiences at times or very different vantage points, how we're able to kind of stand in those shoes, and yet also at the same time understand that we've got our own perspectives and we got our own sort of life experiences. There's got to be something there in this IDI method here that you've invoked before that has some,
the
some answers.
Competence.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. I guess I'm thinking, I mean, a few practical things. One, I think, is obviously to not be racist ourselves, right? Like that's it. And which is not as simple as just being like, okay, well, I'm not racist today, right? It's like, you know, which I think is part of what you're getting at, Justin, that there's this developmental process that we have to go through of recognizing stuff in ourselves and rooting it out. And
yeah,
but I think there's, I don't know, I'm thinking of things like touching base with people, like say, hey, how you doing? I don't know. I mean, I think sometimes that can be weird, right? Like, hey, friend, you know, I think of you as Asian, and I know people are being racist against Asians. So how you doing? Like, I don't know. Is that strange to?
I guess in one sense it could be strange, but in another sense, I could see it could be comforting because there's an acknowledgement that we, you know, as Asians, we are going through that. And that it's not being swept under the rug. So there is a value there to say, man, you know, I acknowledge your pain, I acknowledge this, what you're going through, and I'm not trying to avoid it because it's awkward, but I'm actually, you know, moving into the tension, right? That, I mean, Christ does that. He moves, he doesn't waver again away from the tension. He engages the tension. So I think there's some value to that.
This week is interesting on this podcast because on the one hand, I think we get the opportunity to think about rejoicing with those who rejoice, right? Rejoicing with Dr. Winsenberg in the completion of the doctorate. Yeah. And then I think about, you know, the idea that your family is wrestling with, is it safe to go shopping? And how do we weep with those who weep?
Yeah, McYoung, I'd also be interested to know, you know, as a theologian, are there any things you've been reflecting on theologically, just about the whole pandemic and the whole situation that's kind of maybe been brought to the forefront that you hadn't been reflecting on before, or that maybe just some new thoughts in light of the circumstances?
I mean, not anything, I guess, profound in that sense, but I think just cementing more of a conviction of, you know, kind of my ecclesiology. I think it's interesting when you have conversations with students, especially undergrad students, right? Sometimes they kind of see church as, and they, you know, when we talk about membership and just the necessity of those things, or is it necessary, right? So you're asking those questions, just basic fundamental questions, but profound questions once you dive into it. You know, sometimes I think we have, again, an over-institutionalized view of church where it's like, oh, it's just, oh, membership, like Costco, right? Like fitness type of stuff, you know? And I'm like, I mean, there's some of that, but I think it's deeper than that. So I think those kind of thoughts, especially because we're so restricted from each other, have come more to the forefront and has kind of shaped, this pandemic has shaped the way I've kind of viewed those things and maybe more encouraged to maybe be more intentional. Cause I was talking to my wife, I was thinking like, man, if I had a, you know, if I could teach again, right. If I had another semester to go through or, you know, can continue on, you kind of wonder, would I have the covenantal theme more and not just through that ecclesiology, but through, you know, the Trinitarian God, right? I mean, he's covenantal. Christ is the covenantal figure. The Holy Spirit is the covenantal sign of the New Testament. The scriptures themselves are the covenantal documents, right? So just, I think, making that more clear, especially in the West here, especially in America, where we're so individualistic.
Right.
How can we bring more of that communal aspect into our theology? So those are things that I guess I've been wrestling with in the midst of the pandemic.
Sounds really rich. I really appreciate you being with us, McYoung. It's really good to hear some of these things through your perspective. I really appreciate the time with you.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me, man. It's a privilege.
Appreciate you conversing with us, man. It'd be nice to have you back here at some point talking.
Yeah, for sure, man.
Yeah.
It's good to see you guys.
Yep, see you, McYoung.
So it was really fun having McYoung with us.
Yeah, it was great.
I mean, fun is kind of a weird word because like some of what he was talking about was really heavy.
Yeah. Yeah. That's always the trick, isn't it? You know, on the one hand, it's so good to see him. On the other hand, you know, sometimes we talk about some heavy stuff and it can make it complicated in terms of how we describe it.
Right. Yeah. What's one takeaway that you have from the conversation in terms of how we can better support our Asian American brothers and sisters?
I appreciate all the perspectives that Megan brought to the conversation. I appreciate hearing about just his own concerns, man. It was a sobering reality for me to hear him talking about just his concerns of Debbie going to the grocery store. Mm-hmm. Cause I have never thought of it that way from my own vantage point. I'd never worried about, Jill's not going to the grocery store because she's still around baby a lot. So I'm the one usually going, but just the thought that the fear of going to the grocery store for me has been just catching COVID, right, or passing it on. And the idea though, that there's a whole different experience coming from McYoung and his family and from Hmong brothers and sisters. It opens my eyes up to some of the things I just don't see and don't experience from my own vantage point. Mm-hmm. I appreciate him saying that. Oh, it's painful to hear.
Yeah. I think one of the ways also that maybe we can stand with each other is in prayer, right?
Yeah, for sure, man. And it's, I wonder kind of how this experience is affecting people's patterns of prayer. In some ways, I think it could be an encouragement because, you know, we're getting more kind of time in confined areas. Maybe have more time in some ways for a reflection. In some ways, it can be very difficult, you know, where some people have established patterns of prayers in spaces that are more quiet or that are more, you know, isolated, that they're not going to necessarily get that now, especially if there's a family around or there's, you know, kids running around yelling. So I think it could be a challenge. Mm-hmm. What stuck out to you? Any other things that stuck out to you in terms of just things we could take away from our conversation today with McYoung?
I mean, I think the whole concept of the covenantal relationships that we're in. You know, covenant with Christ, covenant with one another, and to rediscover the meaning of covenant. We've talked about this before, how sometimes I get frustrated with the way that the word covenant is used at the college because it is used to refer to a bunch of rules, you know, the way it kind of feels. Yeah. And not really this sacrificial covenant that's modeled by God with Abraham, you know, God initiating. Sure. And then we see it, you know, clear through scripture, and it's such a rich and beautiful word. And I love that McYoung is maybe helping us rediscover that a bit.
Yeah, I totally agree. In some ways it's unfortunate we use that language to refer to kind of the set of rules that we have. Mm-hmm. But I imagine that conversation is for another time.
It probably is. Yeah. Hey, it's good talking with you.
Good talking with you too. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, have a good week. Yeah, you're exactly. One of the hosts.
I know.
Thank you for joining us this week for Professors in Rooms Getting Coffee. Our theme music is by Josiah Enns. We hope you can join us for coffee again next week.